and welcome to class today. Before we begin, does anybody have any comments, questions, concerns, or other things to address with me? Okay, I have a question for all of you then. So, homework 6, we gave you 20 days to work on it. We did this because we thought you might want 20 days to work on it. So I'm just sort of curious about how progress is going on homework 6. How many of you have... Oh, let's start with this. How many of you have got a bird image to move on the screen? I would encourage you to work on it soon. There's a fair amount of deciding what to do that goes on in this homework. You do not want to have to decide what to do near the end. If you haven't got a bird moving on the screen, that might not be a bad thing. But if that's because you haven't worked on it, that is a bad thing. You're going to want to use the time you have, and you're also going to want to make the TA's life interesting now rather than the last couple of days. So, there's that. All right. So, today, I want to start by talking about programming languages. So, right now, we know one programming language because we've learned it ourselves, Java. I would like to know what other programming languages you know about. So people, give me programming languages. Yes. C++, all right. What else? Python. I'm going to organize them in what may seem like a random way. We'll explain why later. Yes. C#. Yes. Ruby. Yeah. Visual Basic. COBOL. Yeah. JavaScript. Yes? Python. Sorry, somebody else said something. We already have Python. Somebody else said something, though? Nope. Yes?
Android.
It's not actually a language, but that's okay. We'll talk about it anyway. Yeah. HTML. Yeah. CSS. HTML5. Well, that's actually not a language either. We'll put it over here as well. All right. And sorry, you said something. PHP. Yes.
LabVIEW.
Which is actually two different languages, so I'll put it twice. MATLAB. Okay, so we've got a reasonable basis here. A few years ago, there was a survey that went out and found that there are at least 2,000 languages with active user bases of more than 100 programmers. It's a little more than we've got here. I personally know about 70, also a little more than we got here. But that's all right. There are lots and lots of languages out there. Now, most likely, throughout your life, you will not be programming Java most of the time. This is just law of numbers. There is no language with a majority market share. Java has a large market share and a rapidly growing market share because it turns out that Android is Java. Okay? All Android devices programs are written in Java, or nearly all of them. And that has caused Java to grow very rapidly in recent years. But you'll probably be using some other language most of the time because most people use some other language most of the time. There's so many languages. So I'm going to try to give you some feeling for how these languages work, how they're similar and different. We'll explain why they're in columns here. And also to help you understand how that should impact how you're writing code, even for something as early as the very next assignment, and thinking about code in general. So let's talk about what the headers for these columns ought to be. And the headers for these columns have to do with what we discussed last class. Remember last class we said that what a chip can actually store on it is high and low voltages. And by taking groups of these together, we can interpret them to mean different things. How we interpret a particular group of bits is dependent on the type system, the type of the thing. So if it's an int type, we interpret it one way. If it's a float type, we interpret another, a character, another way, a string, and so on. Each of them have their own way of interpreting those bytes. And there's different types of languages. that have different types of types. We have static typed languages, dynamic typed languages, we have markup languages, and other. And we'll talk about these in a moment. So I'm going to talk about the difference between static and dynamic typing today. Hopefully it'll give you a better understanding of how Java's types work, as well as preparing you to work with other languages. But first, let's talk about markup languages. The purpose of a programming language is to describe how to do something, to give instructions to your computer to do actions. That is not the purpose of a markup language. The purpose of a markup language is to describe what something looks like, or to describe information. So in HTML, you don't have loops and you don't have variables. You have things like paragraphs and bold text and menu entries. It's all describing what something looks like. CSS is a different way of describing what things look like that's usually used with HTML. There are lots of other markup languages. There's XML and LaTeX and so on. Many of them we could talk about. But their purpose is not to describe actions. Their purpose is to describe information or appearance. They're generally much easier to learn than programming languages because they lack the complexity of programs. We don't have to worry about algorithms. It's pretty easy once you know how to specify something as a paragraph to decide where the paragraphs go in your text. It's a lot easier to do that than to decide where a loop goes once you know how to specify a loop. That said, the stuff we have learned about Java is not directly transferable to markup languages. You have no obvious advantage in learning HTML now that you didn't have at the beginning of the semester, besides perhaps the idea that you can type source code. However, the programming languages, make sure, all of these programming languages except COBOL look basically the same. And very few people program COBOL anymore. And the basic ideas we have learned learning Java are transferable to the rest as well. So you have a significant advantage in learning other languages as you go. Part of the reason I know 70 languages is because after I learned 4, the rest were really easy. And you will have a similar experience as you learn new languages as you go along in your life. Let's talk briefly about the others here. Android is a platform. It's more like an operating system, like Windows or OS X is an operating system. Most of it's written in Java. HTML5 is HTML plus CSS plus JavaScript 1.7, lumped in all together. So it's not one thing. But the other three things we already have elsewhere on here. So HTML5 is HTML plus CSS plus JavaScript plus modern version. Hey. And so it's sort of this parent title. But that leaves us with programming languages. Before we move on to programming languages, any questions or comments about this or things I should add to the list that I definitely should cover because you're curious? Okay. Static versus dynamic typing. Imagine you have, we don't have to imagine. You have lots of numbers in your life. You have a telephone number. You might have more than one. Your parents probably have telephone numbers. There might also be a household telephone number in your parents' house. You've got a student ID number, and you've got a SIS ID number, which is different than a student ID number for some reason. And you've got a social security number, and on. Lots and lots of numbers in our life. Just like in a computer, we have lots and lots of bits that are sitting around. They mean different things. A student ID number means something different than a telephone number. We cannot use them interchangeably. They have different types. In your life, you have some way of organizing all of these numbers. Some of them you have memorized, but most of them probably you have written down somewhere, and you have some way of knowing what it was you wrote down. And there are, roughly speaking, two kinds of filing systems. Well, make them somewhat exaggerated. One filing system says, I write each number on an identical piece of paper, and then I put those pieces of paper in different locations so I can remember what the number means. So I write on a piece of paper a number that's my phone number, and I put that in my wallet. And I write on a different piece of paper my mother's phone number, and I put that underneath the coffee maker. And I write on a different piece of paper another number, and I put that next to my bed. I put another piece number somewhere else, and where I put it tells me what the number means. So if somebody says, what is your uncle's birth date? I know, I left my uncle's birth date underneath the toilet, and I can go find it, or wherever I happen to have left it, right? That's one filing system. The location tells me the meaning of the number. There's a completely different filing system, which is on each of these pieces of paper, I write down what the number means and the number. So on one piece of paper it says Social Security number, and then it has the number. And another piece of paper it says father's birth date, and it has a number, and so on. I have written down with each of these numbers what they mean. And then I can be completely disorganized and scatter them up and shuffle them and put them wherever I want, because the meaning of the information is stored with the information itself. Okay? So I can either write down what it means on the paper, or I can just remember where I put it. Two filing systems. In computing, these two filing systems are called static or dynamic typing. Okay? So dynamic typing means value... let's do this. We say we store a type with value. Okay? So that's the pieces of paper that have written down what they mean as well as the value. I can move the pieces of paper around, that's fine. In static, I store value and remember type based on location. And Java is one of these separate second types of languages. The static types of languages. It stores the values, but not the types. It remembers the types based on where you put the information, instead of actually storing the type. There are some small exceptions to this you'll get to learn about late in 2110, but for the most part, this is true. So, let's look at what this looks like. In my code, I write int x. What does that mean? It means the position x in memory will always store integers. It is assigning a type to a location. Okay? So somewhere over in my memory, I'm going to have some place where I store type name value. And this says the name x has type int and its value. Oh, let's give it a value. Int x equals 3. And I put a 3 in that box. Okay, so somewhere in memory, Java is storing this information. But all it's actually putting into memory is the value. The type and the name, it just remembers. Okay, it knows what was there later. So later on, I can say something like string s equals h. And that will say, okay, I need a string type thing called s. And its value, now we've been drawing arrows. What Java actually puts in this value is, let's see, how do I do this? I think it's going to be an address, okay? So it's where something is being stored in memory. So somewhere else I have the heap, okay? The heap just sort of stores stuff at some address and a value. It only has addresses and values. It does not have names, it does not have types. So somewhere over here in the heap at memory 7878, I store an H. Okay, so the H goes over there. So this is how Java implements those arrows. It actually puts in the box an address. The address tells it where in memory to go find the value. Okay. If I were doing this properly, I'm not actually storing the address. This is more like the row and column number in my spreadsheet, but I didn't want to go down to row 7878, so I just put it right here. And then as we go through our code and we do things, like saying s equals s plus s, for example, what Java does is it says, what type of thing was s? It was a string type. When I add strings, I make a new, bigger string. So that means I need to make a new, bigger string that has two H's in it. Okay? I need to put that somewhere in memory. I don't know where it goes. And then I assign into this spot that new address. Okay? So what's stored for my variable S is just that new address of where my new string happened to appear. My old address is now garbage. Nothing is talking about it. There's no variables that refer to it. And because there are no variables that refer to it, eventually the garbage collector will come along and say, ah, we can reuse address 7878. It currently has garbage in it. And it will free it. It will put it back in the reusable memory so that later on we can put a different object there instead. Any questions, comments, thoughts about this? Okay, this is static typing. What gets stored is values. That's all that gets stored. And we know the type because we remember the type. Remember the name and the type that was associated with each name. And so when I'm going into memory, I already know how to interpret what I'm going to find there. What actually gets stored in each of these cases is some sort of ones and zeros. So in this particular case, let's see, a 3 is... That's a 3. Okay. This is what actually gets stored in memory. You've got 30 zeros and 2 ones, and that means 3. How this gets mapped, not really important for this course. You'll get to learn a little bit about it depending on the sequence in which you take courses, either in 2330 or in 2150. Okay. But some amount of ones and zeros get stored in each one of these boxes. So that gets stored here, and here we also have just a bunch of zeros and ones, and here we also just have a bunch of zeros and ones. The meaning comes from the type that we expect to find that, from how we decide to interpret it. If we were writing a dynamic language instead, things would look different. In a dynamic language, it doesn't matter where we put things because they have their type stored with them. So I can write nice things like x equals 2, y equals high, and then I can say x equals y. Okay? I can store a string into a variable that used to store an int, and I never have to say whether it should be an int or a string because the variable doesn't care. We don't store types at all, but we may have an x and a y. And initially in the x spot we put int 2, and initially in the y spot we put string 8 high, okay? And then when we assign y to x, we just move that over, okay? Because the type is stored with the value, it doesn't matter what variable we put it in. We never have to write the types, and we can move things around freely. Now, in practice, usually dynamically typed languages, all of this stuff would be out on a heap somewhere, okay? So I'm alighting some details, but the core idea here is that the value goes with the type, and both the type and the value get stored in memory, okay? So it ends up using more memory than would be used in a statically typed language, because we actually have to store the types instead of just using the perfect memory computers have, their perfect recall, to remember what type it had. Questions, comments, thoughts? Yes?
Is there a distinction between ints and doubles?
It depends on the language. So the question was, are there a distinction between ints and doubles? The majority of languages do distinguish between these two. Let's see, from this we had here, Java distinguishes, C++ distinguishes, C# does, COBOL does, LabVIEW C does, Python does, Ruby does, Visual Basic does not, JavaScript does not, PHP does not, LabVIEW, regular LabVIEW does not, MATLAB does not. So a mix. Yes? Did you want me to say more about that or no? Yeah, so that's a good point. All right, if I, in a dynamically typed language, the type is inferred purely from the value. And so if ints and doubles are different, then 2 and 2.0 have different types, behave differently with operators. Which is true in Java too, right? There's a difference in Java between writing 3 divided by 2. Yeah. Dividing 3 divided, that still won't work, will it? Okay, how about writing 123 divided by 34? There we go. And writing 123.0 divided by 34. Okay? The same thing is true in a dynamically typed language. We can figure out the types based on how we wrote the inputs and with the operations we applied to them. But instead of saying, you aren't allowed to store this result in this result in an int variable, there are no variable types, so the value just has a type coming out of it in a dynamic language. Other questions? Okay. So, a dynamic language, you don't have to ever specify types. You don't have to specify them return types. You don't have to specify parameter types. All types, just never have to mention them. Statically typed languages, you do. So let's just take a quick poll. I would rather write a statically typed language. I would rather write a dynamically typed language. I am still alive. Most of you didn't vote. Let's try this again. Just make a decision. It can be arbitrary. I would rather do static. I would rather do dynamic. Looks like about 2-1 in favor of dynamic. Why? Somebody want to defend either side. Why you would prefer one or the other? Obviously, you've only done one, so you don't really know. But still, thoughts. Why would you prefer one or the other? Yes?
Quicker coding with dynamic.
Quicker coding, because...
you don't have to specify everything.
Great. If I don't have to write as much down, I can create my code faster. It takes fewer keystrokes to write a dynamically typed piece of code. Okay? Quicker code. Other reasons for or against either one of them? Yes?
If you have to write more things down, you'd be less likely to get confused if you have to go back to these things.
All right. By writing more things down, we're less likely to be confused. Great point. Other thoughts? That's it. Those are the only two reasons to like or dislike languages. That's fair. I mean, obviously, the reason people use Python is because it's writing less code, and that's the only reason. All right, so let's talk about this a little bit more generally. What makes one program better than another? Okay? So far we've had faster to write the code was one argument, and easier to know what... Sorry, can you repeat what you said?
It's easier to know what you were trying to do.
What you were trying to do. Okay? Other things that might make one program better than another. Yes? Memory usage, more or less, is good.
Less.
Uses less memory. Yeah?
In the static program, you have declared types. You're less likely to make up to mess up.
Less likely to make errors. I guess I should say making mistakes, because making error has a slightly different linguistic meaning. Any other reason we might prefer one program over another? Yes? It runs faster. Other reasons? Yes?
More intuitive.
More intuitive. Could you say a little bit more about that?
Maybe some programs, like you can look at it and you can tell
it's... So more intuitive code. Okay.
It's easy to learn.
Easier to what?
To learn.
Easier to learn. Okay, so we have all these things that can make one program better than another. And yet you've all decided between programs from time to time. For example, what browser do you use? How do you decide between Firefox and Opera and Conqueror and Chrome and Internet Explorer and Galleon and Safari and Midori and Iceweasel and whatever else you like to use? How do you make that decision? Is it based on it's faster to write the code, it's easier to know what you're trying to do? Is any of these the reason? Sorry? Runs faster? So you use, what browser do you use?
I use Safari.
Safari, and you use Safari because it's faster than the others? No. Why do we pick them? Yes?
Minimalism.
Minimalism. What do you mean by that?
Basically, for Chrome, I just have like the tabs, the search bar, and the bookmark.
Ah, so cleaner user interface. Okay? Other reasons? Yeah? Great. So if you use Internet Explorer, you can only use Windows, right? You can only use Windows phones, only use Windows tablets. Nothing else has it. So there's this issue of compatibility. Other reasons? Yes?
Security.
OK. So can you tell me any program you chose for its security? Nope. But in theory, we could choose a program based on security, right? Has anybody chosen a program based on its security? One. Out of 120 people in the room, one person, well, and me as well, so two. Okay? But still, it's a reason. Other reasons we might choose one program over another. Yes?
Perhaps like the availability of add-ons.
Ah. Add-ons. Okay, so there's certainly more programs available for Windows than OS X. There's more programs available for OS X than there is for Linux. There's more programs available for Linux than there is for FreeBSD, more for FreeBSD than Haiku, and so on. And this is true of other types of scenarios as well. There are more plugins for Word than there are for WordPerfect. Okay. Yes?
Cost.
Almost every piece of code I ever run is free. I love it. But many people actually spend money on programs. Shocking behavior. All right. I want to mention a different one here. How about correctness? Okay. Does it do what it's trying to do correctly? So, let's think about this for a moment. Just a quick poll. I want you to cast your mind back to the last time you had some software fail on you. Do something it wasn't supposed to do, crash, reveal a bug, do something wrong. Okay, think back to the last time that happened. Now, for how many of you was that more than a month ago? It's been more than a month since something went wrong.
Oh.
Well, the programs you write, I don't really care. Okay, so a fair number of us have been more than a month, but the majority of us has been less than a month. Less than a week. In the last week, something went wrong with some of my programs. Okay, that's about half, a little over half of us. Less than 3 days, so since Friday, something went wrong. Still about half of us. In the past 24 hours, so since 3 o'clock on Sunday. Wow, we're still about 20%. Okay, so it sounds like somewhere between 3 days and 24 hours is how long it takes for our computers to fail, on average. Now, let's think about something else. Chairs. Okay? Think about the last time you had a chair fail on you. Okay? I have never had a chair fail on me. That's about a third of us. It's been more than a year since I last sat in a chair and it didn't work. Well, that's almost all of us. Okay, so chairs are a whole lot more reliable than code. Kitchen appliances, okay? It's been more than a year since a kitchen appliance failed on me. I've never had a kitchen appliance fail on me. Okay, so between those two, that was most of you there. Is there anything that fails as often as code? What fails a lot?
Batteries.
Sorry? Tests. Well, most of you failed, had a thing fail on you in the past 3 days. How many of you have failed a test in the past 3 days? Okay, right? So even tests are more reliable. So why? Why do programs break all the time? What's wrong with them? What's wrong with code? Yeah?
Because of programmers.
Okay, so why do programs fail? And you're saying because programmers fail. Okay, that's a reasonable idea. I like that. It's fairly vague, though. Why do programmers fail? Are they just like stupider than all other types of engineers, right? I mean, chairs, right? They work. When they don't work, it's something you like tell somebody because it's funny. You don't like call up your mom and say, you'll never guess what happened when I opened Internet Explorer. It didn't load the web page. Isn't that amazing? Everybody around me laughed. But if your chair collapses on you, you frequently do that kind of thing. So why? Why do programs fail? What's wrong with us? Yeah.
We always figure out how to break them.
We figure out how to break them. Okay. Is it easier to break Internet Explorer or a chair? So unclear. You need a sledgehammer to break some chairs, but if you have one of those, it's not too hard, right? But you're saying we actively go out and say, you know what I want to do today? I want Word to crash. I don't think we do that. If you do, there's a particular job for you that will work really well. You're welcome to come up and talk to me afterwards about how you can make millions of dollars. Why do they break? Yeah.
Very complex.
Do you think the average, 12-year-old can make a chair that works pretty well?
Yeah.
Meh. You might not want it long term, but it'll work for a few days, right? They don't need any training. They have never taken a course on chair design, right? But we expect most of us can make a reasonable chair if asked to. It wouldn't be pretty. But most of you, even after a full semester of programming, you can kind of make programs. Homework 5, for example, about half of your submissions, when I ran my testing code, Java told me, without my asking it to, one way to break your code. Just immediately, as soon as I received your code, it said, warning, here's how to break their code. Okay? I didn't even request that. It just told me. Now, why did it do that? Because I didn't tell you about that particular warning and how to fix it, yada yada. But, right, you've had months of training. In months of training, you can make chairs all right. You could probably even make microwaves without that many bugs. Okay? So there's a great deal more complexity here. What else? Yeah?
It runs out of your resources.
Resources are limited. Okay, let's think about this for a moment. Our kittens. Remember our kittens? We decided a kitten takes somewhere between 20 and 50 bytes, and so we could get several hundred million kittens before we run out of memory. It's hard for me to imagine a program where I would need several hundred million kittens. Maybe if I'm like trying to simulate evolution as a whole. You still can do this. And the way you do this is usually if you're using if you're somehow keeping track of everything so nothing ever becomes garbage, you can run out of resources. You can actually, if you want to break a program, forcing it to run out of resources is one of the easiest ways to do that. So just try to do big stuff over and over again, and you can usually get a program to crash. But there's certainly that. Other ideas, yeah?
Hostile
users. Not hostile. Hostile users. Users, not uses. Okay. How many of you have heard of Stuxnet? Okay. The CIA, probably, they of course deny it, but probably the CIA, decided that they didn't like Iran's uranium enrichment program. So they wrote a virus, a very specific virus, that attacked the control software for uranium centrifuges. Okay? And what it would do is it would just sort of turn off the safety on the uranium centrifuge, so it'd spin too fast and break. And then they got this into a uranium enrichment plant, and all these centrifuges, which are, you know, gigantic metal tubes full of very heavy metals spinning very fast, they started spinning so fast that they literally ripped off of their bearings and tore through walls and destroyed the building. This was a virus, okay? There are hostile users whose goal is to figure out how can I break your code? There are lots of these people. There's money to be made there, though surprisingly little money. It's not a particularly lucrative job, but there's enough people who are bored and mean that this happens, okay? I know that I have received a virus on my computer. Yeah, About half of us. So that probably means the other half of us still have a virus on our computer. Okay. So that certainly hurts. Of course, it's hard to imagine what a virus would look like for a chair. So there's some amount of this complexity that still matters even with hostile unit users. Other things that might cause them to fail? We are okay with it. This is one really big one. If I buy a car, which is also a complex system and has a bunch of computers in it, 20 to 40 depending on the car you buy. If I buy a car and I'm driving it for a few hours and then it just stops, or like the engine turns off and starts up again while I'm on the freeway, okay, which happens frequently with our computers essentially, I would be upset. I would go to the car manufacturer and demand my money back or that they fix it for free or something. When my code does that, I just wait for it to come back on and start again, right? Because we've trained ourselves to believe that computers will fail. They will always fail. And so we just live with it. It's actually so bad. I don't know if you've ever read an end-user license agreement, the EULAs that show up for every software you have. But almost every single one of them includes somewhere in there a statement of warranty in which they will say, this product has no warranty, including even the implied warranties of mercantility or fitness for a particular purpose. In legalese, what that means is, what we gave you is so not a product, it is immoral to sell it because it doesn't work and it doesn't do anything. That's what that means. Right? So you cannot say it fails to do something because it has no purpose legally. It's not supposed to do anything, so anything it happens to do is just a happy accident. Woohoo! Right? And this is just like mind-boggling, right? Like how? How have we just decided, yeah, all code is just sort of random. It might work, it might not. Oop. But we have. Part of the reason we have is because it's hard to write correct code. It is very complex. And writing code that just works and always works is a difficult thing to do. It can be done. There's a professor here at UVA, John Knight, who is a big proponent of provably correct programs. And I have written programs of quite a bit larger than any you've written in this class, where I have a detailed mathematical proof that it works and that you can't break it in this way and that. This takes a long time. Hey, it's hard to do. And usually, people will buy it if it has bugs, so why would I fix it? Right? Make it, sell it, move on. Hooray! But it is possible. And there are people that claim that we ought to move more in that direction. The problem is just we don't demand it as users, as a market. We don't really care. As long as it lets us save our work frequently enough that we can get something done, we usually just go with it. So that happens. So, as we're thinking about different programs, it's worth thinking about what are we optimizing for? Are we trying to make it secure? Are we trying to make it easy to make add-ons? Are we trying to make it run fast? Or do we just want to make it easy to write code? Right? Faster to write the code. Is that our goal? It's not a bad goal. Okay? For homework, it may be the right goal. But we'll talk some more on Wednesday about how you make these trade-offs and how to analyze algorithms and think about what makes them better or worse to sort of move forward with that. Questions, comments, thoughts before I switch gears a little bit? Okay. I want to go now to the schedule. At this point, you could get paid to write programs. You may not believe this, but it is nonetheless true. If you think, for example, about Flappy Birds, okay, made a lot of money, is a lot simpler to program than Homework 6. When you finish Homework 6, you'll have done 3 to 5 times as much work as the Flappy Birds guy. Okay? And you can do that. It'll take you a few weeks, and hooray, you're done. So let me just sort of reemphasize. You came in and we had to say, what is this whole thing we're talking about? We played around with turtles, but you didn't really know what was going on. You just like did what we did and changed stuff until it worked-ish. We started talking about input and output and what types mean at a very high level, right? We've seen a lot more about that. We talked about if statements, and what encryption is, and how to write loops, arrays, and reading files, and CSV, other kinds of lists, how to write methods, how to write your own types to extend the language to do new things. Hey, you know a lot. You know enough to get a job. Now, most of you won't go out and try to get a job right now, and most people won't hire you based on 3/4 of a semester. But here's what will happen to a lot of you. You will never take another programming class. You will get a job doing whatever it is you think you want to do with your life. After you're there for about a year, somebody will say, oh, if only we had a program to do this. And you will make the mistake of mentioning, I had a programming class once. And say, oh! And then you'll be asked to write that program, and a few years down the road, you'll find yourself a full-time software engineer, and you've only ever had one class, and you're making up the rest of it as you go. I say this will happen because this happens all the time. The Bureau of Labor Statistics suggests that between 2 and 3 times as many jobs in computing exist as degrees are offered in the field. Somewhere between 1/2 and 2/3 of programmers have no educational background in the software they are writing. And this, frankly, is part of why a lot of programs break. Right? Because a lot of them are written by people who have about your experience. And then they teach themselves on the fly, and everybody's happy because they can make the computer do amazing things. So this happens. So we're going to try in the remaining part of the semester to give you a few tools that you can use when that happens to you, as it will. So we're going to talk about different ways that code can be good on Wednesday. We'll evaluate different ones of those, get some information from you as well about that. We'll talk about how to design an algorithm. How do you come up with the right way to do something? How do you decide which one's better? Then we'll talk about 2 other little pieces that are useful for your thinking. Recursion methods that call themselves. And we'll talk about how you can make classes use each other and think about what's actually going on without your head exploding. Okay, that's the rest of the semester. So that's what's coming ahead. And the next few classes will be mostly about this sort of how you design things. So let's start on that right now with something very practical. Let's consider homework 6. Okay? In homework 6, we give you a few pieces of code that have lots of stuff missing and some stuff not there at all. And then we give you this fairly vague list of stuff to do. Have 2 players, have gravity, etc. So how do you go about tackling this? This is so much more specific than whatever your employer will ask you to do later in your life is. They will have some vague thing like, we want a database. And you're like, database? I have never taken a database course. I wonder what that means. Right? So we tell you a lot about what we want to do. We even showed you an example. Okay? But how do you design this? How do you decide what to do? One way is you just start writing the finished product right now. You start adding code and adding code and adding code until it works. And this is a bad idea. Okay? It's probably how you've done previous assignments. Those of you I've seen code, this is how you've done previous assignments. It does not scale well. It is not a good idea at the large scale. So let me talk about how I did this. I designed this homework assignment. That meant I wrote it first. I wrote several different versions until I found one simple enough that my explanation would make sense and be easy for you to do. How did I do this? Essentially what I did was I wrote a 3-line of code program. And I ran it. And it worked. And so I added another line, and I ran it, and it still worked. So I added another line, and I ran it, and it didn't work. So I removed that line, tried something else, and I ran it, and it worked. I got about 10 lines that created a window and let me draw things on the window. And they said, great, I know how to draw windows. I started over with another 2-line program, and I ran it. And it worked kind of, and I tweaked it around, and I ran it. And then I added 3 more lines, and I ran it over and over again until I had this, 10-line version of a bird class. And then I said, great, I have a basic structure of a bird. Now let's think about gravity. How does gravity work? And I wrote a line for that, and it wasn't right. And I wrote another line, and I ran that, and it wasn't right. And I ran another line, and that seemed to work all right. It was only 1 line, but now I knew what the line looked like. Great, now let's think about drag. And I just move 1 step at a time. I wrote all these little programs. Most of them I threw away. Okay? But the goal was to test one idea at a time. Programs are very complex. Lots of pieces all working together. The way you should think about complex problems is by breaking them into simple problems. And think about something small enough you can fit the whole thing in your head at one time. Okay? If it's too big to fit all in your head at one time, then when something breaks, you don't know why. So you want to write little pieces. So that's how you go about tackling a problem like this. You say, ah, what is one little piece I could do all by itself? And I do that little piece. That's partly how we designed the Fragile Asteroids program. Okay? We wanted you to be able to do a fairly small piece of things moving. Even that's larger than I would suggest you usually start with, right? Just add a few things here, a few things there, and get them working by themselves. Once you have an idea of how the little pieces work, then you can think about how can you tie them together. How do you take the pieces and tie them together into something that works as a whole? Maybe as I'm trying to do that, I'll discover, you know, the way I figured out if somebody is pressing the keys isn't a good way to do that in my new design for how all the pieces work together. Let's go back and think of other ways to figure out if somebody's pressing keys. Now, in this particular instance, I gave you a method that tells you if people are pressing keys. It wasn't the first method I wrote, okay? But I've done some of that for you. But you're going to want to do something similar. As you go along, little pieces. Get them down, make sure you understand them, then you can move on to another little piece. And once you have the little pieces, then you can start assembling them. This will make your life easier now. It will make your life easier programming in the future. Okay. Any questions, thoughts about languages, design? Yes?
Do you have a recommendation on which class to write first?
Which class should you write first? I don't care. I would start with a main method and start playing around with stuff. Okay? Or maybe I would say, well, I know some stuff a bird has to have. Right? It's got to be able to have a position and a motion, so I can start there and make a little half-hearted bird. I would expect, though, that you'll write more than one copy of some of them. It's also worthwhile when I give you some guidelines like I do here, I say you should make a collision box class. Why did I say that? I said you don't have to turn it in, so why did I suggest you do that? Understanding the purpose of that idea may help you. You don't have to do it. My first version of Joust did not have a collision box. But then I thought, oh dear, I know it's going to trip people up, and this will make their life easier. Okay? So you're welcome to start there as well. But starting where to start suggests that you're just sort of working through it in order. And if you're working through it in order, you'll probably paint yourself into a corner. Yes? I gave you a method in Joust screen. There is a key pressed method, and it checks for the A key and currently the left key and prints stuff out. That's what I gave you. Okay? Presumably, you would add your other key action, your other things to react to keys in there, hence the to do, handle keys. Other questions? Okay. I never really answered one question we asked earlier, so let me go back and do that. I asked you, why would you prefer static versus dynamic? Let me tell you. It takes less code to write a dynamic program, dynamically typed language, but it's harder to read afterwards. When I look at a method that has types, has a return type and parameter types, I have an intuitive understanding of what it does. If I see an add method that takes two integers, I understand that it's doing mathematical addition. If I see an add method that takes a list and an integer, I understand that it's probably sticking something on a list. There's meaning in a static program. It makes it easier to read, easier to maintain, easier to change. We've taught you static language in part because it's popular, in part because it helps you think about what's going on in a way that the dynamic languages won't. Most of you will most likely find yourself writing more dynamic languages than static languages throughout your life. Because dynamic languages are good for little 10-line throwaway programs. And a lot of people find themselves writing a lot of 10-line throwaway programs. I just tried to count. Last week I wrote somewhere over 40 of them. Little programs I threw away, never even bothered saving, just wrote them and ran them and tossed them. So there are dynamic languages for those sort of short problems, static for the big ones. When we come back on Wednesday, we'll talk more about how you decide what's good and bad, how do you measure that, and I will see you all then.